New York City in the 1980s was in the grip of one of the worst crime epidemics in its history. But then, suddenly and without warning, the epidemic tipped. The murder rate peaked in 1990, then went into a steep and precipitous decline. Murders dropped by two-thirds. Felonies were cut in half. Other cities saw their crime drop in the same period, but in no place did the level of violence fall farther or faster. On the subways, by the end of the decade, there were 75% fewer felonies than there had been at the decade's start. The idea of crime as an epidemic, it must be said, is a little strange. We talk about epidemics of violence, or crime waves, but it's not clear that we really believe that crime follows the same rules of epidemics as, say, hush puppies did, or Paul Revere's ride. Those epidemics involve relatively straightforward and simple things, a product and a message. Crime, on the other hand, isn't a single discrete thing, but a word used to describe an almost impossibly varied and complicated set of behaviors. Criminal acts have serious consequences. They require the criminal to do something that puts himself at great personal peril. To say that someone is a criminal is to say that they are evil or violent or dangerous or dishonest or unstable or any combination of any of those things, none of which are psychological states that sound like they can be transmitted, casually, from one person to another. Criminals do not, in other words, sound like the kind of people who could be swept up by the infectious winds of an epidemic. Yet somehow, in New York City, this is exactly what happened. In the years between the beginning and the middle of the 1990s, New York City did not get a population transplant. Nobody went out into the streets and successfully taught every would-be delinquent the distinction between right and wrong. There were just as many psychologically damaged people and criminally inclined people living in the city at the peak of the crime wave as at the trough. But for some reason, tens of thousands of those people suddenly stopped committing crimes. How did that happen? The answer lies in the third of the principles of epidemic transmission, the power of context. The law of the few looked at the kinds of people who are critical in spreading information. The section on Sesame Street looked at the question of stickiness, suggesting that in order to be capable of sparking epidemics, ideas had to be memorable and move us to action. We've looked at the people who spread ideas, and we've looked at the characteristics of successful ideas. But the subject of this section, the power of context, is no less important than the first two. Epidemics are sensitive to the conditions and circumstances of the times and places in which they occur. In Baltimore, syphilis spreads far more in the summer than in the winter. Hush puppies took off because they were being worn by kids in the cutting-edge precincts of the East Village, an environment which helped others to look at the shoes in a new light. It could even be argued that the success of Paul Revere's Midnight Ride, in some way, owed itself to the fact that it was made at midnight. At midnight, everyone is home in bed, which makes them an awful lot easier to reach than if they're off on errands or working in the fields. And if someone wakes us up to tell us something, we automatically assume the news is going to be urgent. One can only imagine how Paul Revere's afternoon ride might have compared. This much, I think, is relatively straightforward. But the lesson of the power of context is that we are more than just sensitive to changes in context. We're exquisitely sensitive to them. And the kind of contextual changes that are capable of tipping an epidemic are very different than we might ordinarily suspect.